British intelligence, Jamaican restaurants, runaway cage fighters, and the South Sydney Rabbitohs. This week on Thereabouts Outspoken.
Anyway, you guys got a lot of grit.
G'day, hi, howdy, hello, how's it going? Welcome to the program, and boy oh boy, it is another fantastic episode. My name is Angus Morton. I am sitting here, halfway across the country from my co-host, Isaac Carson. Isaac, in today's episode, there is a lot of reminiscing about things we've done and things we were meant to do, but were unable to for some reason. Tell me, is there anything you wish you'd done but haven't for one reason or another?
Yeah, Gus. I mean, there's a whole list of things that I wish I've done and haven't yet. And the list keeps getting longer, especially, you know, I'm locked down with the COVID. Definitely have come up with some plans. But I think hearing from Scott really made me realize that so many unexpected and great things can happen by just being open and jumping at opportunities that come up along the way, which is sort of what happens with the first Thereabouts.
You're totally right. I find both the very best things in my life and also the very worst have come about as a result of, you know, just being open to things. Before we jump into it, I should also note we owe everybody an apology. We had intended, and last week we said we would release the first film in our Sometime Thereafter series. However, under the current circumstances, timelines have been shifted with our distributors, and we will have word on when that is dropping. I dare not say a date because it'll only be delayed. So, you know, it will be soon, very soon, but, you know, when that is not 100% clear just yet. Let's talk about today's episode. Today, we're going all the way back to where it all began, the trip to Uluru. We sat down with Scott Mitchell, the director of the very first Thereabouts, to talk the lunch that landed him on the way to Uluru, recognizing the bigger story as it emerges, the challenge of asking your best mates some hard questions, as well as his filmmaking process.
We finished things off with a discussion about what makes sports so great and what we hope will continue to make it great once it resumes.
I guess we should just go for it. G'day, Scott. How are you doing, buddy?
Mate, very well. Good to see you in these very strange times. It's been a while.
It has been. Tell me, where are you right now?
So I'm in Sydney, and we're all working from home at the moment. We sort of have similar restrictions to a lot of the US, not sort of as bad as New York or Spain or London, fortunately. But we're all at home working from home. But look, I'm safe and well, and I hope you are, and I hope anyone who's listening is safe and well too.
So today, I thought it would be a good idea to get back on. As you said, we're in quite strange times, and I've been thinking about, you know, the first Thereabouts film, and I thought it would be great to get you on and like have a talk about the making of that film, however many years later, 6 years later. But first, like, maybe how about you tell us a little bit about how you ended up, well, how did you end up coming onto the onto the Thereabouts project? Like, what was your job? What were you doing? And how did that relationship start?
Sure. So I am a TV producer or a journalist. I've kind of done so many different sides of that coin. I'm not quite sure which I'm on, but I was a journalist at the ABC, which is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, kind of like the BBC in the UK, or imagine for anyone in America, PBS, if it was sort of the biggest news channel in the country, which it obviously isn't. And so I made sort of this weird youth current affairs show that you were working in the same production company as, and got a job there. And then I produced some other TV shows, you know, now I'm still in that game. I'm at the ABC now as the digital lead of Audio Current Affairs, which is all of the network's podcasting and radio programs that are kind of current affairs. But back then, I had just come back from living in Beirut, where I was trying to be a foreign correspondent at the age of about like 24 or 25, which was probably a bad idea to try and cover the Syrian civil war when I was like 25, and had the most amazing time in a lot of ways and learned so much about the world, but was not ready to do that. And I'd come back, I'd had a couple of jobs. And then you basically said at a pub one day that your brother was coming home to Australia. You were thinking of trying to record it somehow, or at least get some photos that you could kind of use to pitch later and do something with. And I think you weren't quite sure what then, but you had an idea of doing sort of something around adventure sport stuff. And you thought it would be a good opportunity. And I think you had someone lined up to come along and take photos and do video, and then they dropped out. And I was in between jobs at the time, and I was like, well, I could come. And then very quickly found myself with a camera, I think just a Canon 5D, pretty basic camera, coming along with you two, basically. Is that about how you remember it?
I was just going to say, you're pretty much, my memory is even more succinct than that. I remember going to lunch at like a Jamaican restaurant or something, like some sort of a, like, exactly above a pub in Surry Hills. And it was you, Kirk Docker, who, for the audience listening, if you listened to last week's show, Mitch Docker, his older brother, Kirk, is, I guess, kind of how Scott and I met. He's a TV producer in Sydney, where I used to live. And we were all at lunch together, and we were talking about going, like, I was telling you guys about, oh, we're about to go and do a trip. And I feel like it was like in 4 days' time.
Or yeah, like 3 days' time.
It was really close to you.
Yeah, it was like we were leaving on Sunday and we were having lunch on Friday. And you were just like, there's no good reason for me not to, so therefore I'm compelled to do it. And so we just left, and I don't even think at that point we were like, let's make a documentary or anything.
Yeah, I think from memory we definitely didn't set out to make a documentary, and I didn't even set out, I think, to really work in a way. I sort of was like, oh, you're going to Uluru. I've never been to Uluru. So many Australians. It's the most incredible place in the world. And so Australians have never been there. And I was like, well, when in my life am I going to get to drive across my country and see Uluru? And I just kind of sort of came based off that, because I just came off a contract, was waiting for another TV contract to come, and went on it. And if we, both of us worked in television at the time, and if we planned to make a documentary, I think it's clear, if anyone wants to look it up for the first time, watch the film after you listen to this podcast, it's clear that we did not go out to shoot a film, because we would have brought a lot more equipment and we would have shot a lot more. And it was only a couple of days in to the journey, and I'm shooting some stills, some video for, like, I think a little 5-minute sizzle reel. And it just became sort of apparent that there was something going on that was worth investing more effort into and more time into. And then suddenly I actually start shooting everything, really, or trying to document as much as we can, doing interviews after every day's ride, shooting as much of the ride as we could. And suddenly it shifted from like, well, I'm just going to be in the car while these guys ride and we'll get to Uluru, to actually kind of working and making it.
Yeah, because I don't remember, I certainly wasn't conscious of like that point when it went from being a 5-minute sizzle reel to like a full film.
To be honest, I think I probably hid from you in a way that I came to, I think on the second day of the ride, I probably thought that I wanted to try and shoot it as a documentary. And I think I probably didn't say that. I think about 2 days in or 3 days into the trip, I said something to you like, I'm gonna really shoot this, and I'm gonna get interviews with you both. and you were just so buggered because you're barely holding on in those first few days in particular, like your fitness wasn't up. So you were so buggered that I think you probably only absorbed about half of that information. But I know that in the back of my head during the shoot, I was like, I think there's something here and I want to actually have a proper crack at making a film here. And to name that, I mean, basically for anyone who hasn't seen it or even, you know, it's pretty, in a lot of ways, this is subtext if you have seen it, is, you know, I didn't know Lachlan at all when I started that. I'd never met Lachlan before. And we were friends, but I didn't know anything about your life in cycling. And you didn't really talk about it a lot. And so it took a few days for suddenly, as I'm shooting it and interviewing you, I suddenly realize, first of all, oh, wow, Lachlan actually doesn't really like what he's doing. He doesn't like cycling. And you're, even though you have fallen out of it and you actually hate it, you're trying to make him love it again. That's interesting. And you're not really saying that to each other, but that's the subtext of what's going on. I'm like, that's a pretty amazing thing to try and get your brother to back in love with something that you yourself hate. And then as I started to interview about that and try and pull that out, you know, a few days later, I sort of realized that I'm like, why does he hate it so much? Why did he hate cycling so much? Why did he leave cycling? And I sort of figure out, even before we got it on camera, I think I was sort of getting hints of it, is that you had this struggle with eating disorder, with your body, with all this stuff that's going on. And just as somebody who's a journalist and a filmmaker, you're like, well, this is suddenly a story. This isn't just... it's, of course, you know, if you go anywhere with your friends doing something challenging, of course there's going to be emotions and that's all really nice and that's great. Yeah. And, you know, anyone who's going on a trip, fantastic. But when you start to connect it to, you know, some social issues or, you know, the economy of sport and how that plays, suddenly that's a story. And I suddenly got, you know, it was both intimidating, because when you realize that you have a story, you go, oh, fuck, I'm going to have to ask my friends some really difficult questions. And this is going to be really, you know, you're both riding really hard. You do not have time for this. And, you know, there were times when, you know, we'd drive in that car for a few hours and no one would say a word, because who wants to sit down for a 45-minute interview when you're fucked? Who wants to... you know, why are we shooting all this stuff? Like, what's the point of all this? And, you know, I'm getting frustrated at whatever, and you have to confront those things. But ultimately, I'm really glad that we ended up going, no, it's worth the difficulty of confronting this to make something. And I think we did that.
What do you think it was about riding our bikes from Port Macquarie to Uluru that like brought this story out?
Well, I rewatched the film for the first time in a long time on the weekend to kind of get ready for this interview. And there's so many things in that film that even at the time we would have done differently. You know, I think there's all kinds of, you know, the sound isn't perfect, the pacing isn't great. There's all kinds of things. But I think one of the things I'm proudest of in that film is the section from Mari, which is this town, for people who don't know, in really central desert Australia, in a lot of ways near Lake Eyre and near Coober Pedy. Some of the most there's one police officer for that entire area, and it's the size of Belgium. So that is the kind of area we're talking about. And that section from Mari to Coober Pedy, that sort of 7-minute section, I think stands up as something really special and worth all of the mistakes of the rest of the film. Just that part is incredible. And I am proud of that. I think what brought it out there and why that section is so amazing is, I mean, first of all, Australia is an incredible country and there's nowhere else like it. And being, I mean, first of all, difficulty. When you two are doing that level of effort, difficulty is going to bring out emotion. When you're going through something that physical, it brings out emotion. Then you're exploring the place that we're all from and our own country, but you're seeing, I mean, it's not in the film, which is a big flaw of it, but, you know, you're connecting with during the trip, we're connecting with the sort of indigenous people of this country whose land it is, you know, the country is their land and was never ceded. And we're connecting with that in a way that none of us had before. I think that was hugely emotional for a lot of us. That time being alone, you know, you don't in your life get much time, you know, to have, what was it, 12 days or something with four people. You get to know each other really well and intimately. And also, I think you and Lachlan probably hadn't spent that long together in what, almost maybe 8 years or something. So you've got two brothers who haven't spent that much time together in a long time. And so a lot is being brought up. What did you find? What were the things that you found?
So for me, riding my bike had always been about one thing, and that was getting faster, like, and beating other people, like competition, right? So everything that I did around the bike was towards racing and competition. It was almost like I was riding a bike because that was just my outlet of competition, right? It wasn't like I had an attachment with the bicycle. I just happened to be good at it, and that was the way that I could exercise my like competitiveness. So the first thing I think was like, and I remember this so well now, and it seems strange to me now that I didn't recognize, like I never thought differently about the bike, but like when Lachlan suggested that we ride like halfway across the country, you know, for fun, I was sort of like, what? Like the only people that I sort of had ever seen do something like that were like, you know, middle-aged German cyclo tourists, right? Like, and so I sort of was like, but why on earth, why would you ever want to do that? Like, what are we getting out of it? The first thing for me was like, on that, it was on the second, I think it was on the second day or the into Gunnedah, where I was like, I overheated. It was like 180 kilometers. It was really hot. And I was just so cooked. That for me was the moment where I was like, wait, there's no reason to be doing this. So why are we doing it? And there was something in that point, like at that point in time, I was like, oh wait, I'm just doing this for me and for Lockie, and like, we're doing this together. I'm allowed to, like, I don't know. It was like one of those things where you have a shared experience together. It was like the first time I'd had a shared experience, and that be the point of it. And so from that, like that moment, my whole attitude changed towards the way we were riding. My entire worldview really started to shift. And all of a sudden I was like, oh yeah, like you can learn a bunch from experience, you know, like, and that kind of opened me up. Like when we went to the Marie pub, right? Like we were like pouring our own beers, and like the guy's like, let's go and shoot this gun.
And also, and something like, that's not in the film, by the way, is that that guy was like a former cage fighter from Port Augusta. And the other guy that worked at the pub was like former British Air Force intelligence. And these two guys couldn't be more different, but they just were running the pub and we were the only people in it. So these two guys who are complete lunatics and so different were just running that pub, and we're just basically like, all right, guys, we'll, you know, just pour your own beers and we'll sort it all out later. And I think barely charged us for half of what we drank and ate, and just wanted to hang out with us and play. It was, you know, that if no one's been out there, huge recommendation, because there really are, it feels like there are no rules in a lot of ways, or people are making up rules and norms as they go. Right. And so there's also some, I think we were also experiencing like a crazy amount of freedom. You know, at one point, you know, you, Locke, and Chris Farco, the trainer, mechanic, driver, are like skateboarding on a tiny skateboard out the back of holding onto the back of the car. Like, you can't do that in Australia, just to clarify. That's not road rules. And so, like, you know, we could really do anything in a lot of ways. You know, half the film was shot with me standing on the on top of the handbrake center console of the car with half my body through the sunroof, and I'm holding the camera through the sunroof, and we're doing, you know, whatever it is, you know, 100k an hour maybe to catch up to you, go around the side and film a kind of tracking shot of you. And obviously I'm not wearing a seatbelt. I don't have a harness. I don't have a helmet. And I think we even had, you know, we had police go by us when we were doing that kind of stuff. And they're just like, oh yeah, whatever. Because out in the middle of nowhere, you know, they can't be bothered dealing with that stuff. They don't care. And so there was a lot of freedom we went through. But just on that point as well about how it changed your, you know, view of the bike and of I think sport, you know, I think that's something else. If I were to list the things I'm proud of, one is that we confronted those themes and actually brought a story out and in it, and did it, you know, setting aside some friendship, I think, to be like, you know, I asked you some really difficult questions. You gave me really honest answers. I'm proud of that.
Yeah, I would agree. I think like there's something about the honesty of that story, I think, that all of a sudden, like, to your point, right, like you said, it was like all of a sudden, like, the freedom of it. And I don't even really know how to, I don't even really know how that was, how that's conveyed, like, but it is. And I think that's what's gone on. Certainly I've noticed, like, or like, you know, you have people come and talk about that film and like what it did for them. And I think what happened to us on that trip, like, as then a result, like, you know, learning by shared experience or whatever, other people were able to then have that same freeing kind of experience, and the sport was opened up to them. Let's move on to, well, what, do we have anything else that we want to cover about that first trip?
I think one of my regrets to this day is that I wish I found some money. You were so incredible at A, sharing all that stuff with me, but then putting me in a position to, you know, got to make a feature documentary at like 25 or whatever. And that's basically down to you. You edited that film, you planned that trip, you took it through. So, you know, I'm super glad that that happened. I wish I found a way to stump up some of my cash and get it sound mixed. So anyone who watches watch out for that sound mixing.
Anyone who wants to mix it and grade it. I actually, do you know what I did? We should talk about, so the music for that film was written by our friend Monty and of the Delta Rigs. Yeah, look him up on Spotify. And he was a good friend of ours and they wrote all the music for that film. Anyway, I lost all of those hard drives when I moved from Australia to the US. I don't know, like, I didn't know what I'd done with them. I couldn't find them. Like 2 months ago, I found them. I had two or three dead hard drives, and I'd been like looking for them because I really wanted to find the music. I couldn't find the music anywhere. And like countless people have pestered me over the years, like actually pestered, like people just sending you multiple messages like, yo, where can I get that music? Like, why won't you tell me where it is? Anyway, I found these three hard drives, and on a very snowy, gloomy day here in Colorado, I drove them to a nondescript tech center building on the outskirts of Denver, and I went up to the second floor, and I buzzed on a door, and a tall, very burly Ukrainian man answers the door, and he's in this dark little office that's like piled high with hard drives. And I gave him my hard drives, and he's like, I will see what I can do. And then he, like, no word for like 3 weeks. And then I get this call, and he's like, your hard drives are ready. Anyway, I got the drives back, and there's all the original music plus all the edit files, all the Final Cut 6 or 7 or whatever we're cutting on at the time. So it's all there. I found them, and so I've got the music back, and I put, if you want, dude, we should do a remaster. We should do a grade on it. Because when I was watching it the other day, because I haven't watched it for ages, it's really hard for me to go back and watch. And so, yeah, going back, I was like, this could do with a little polish, with a quick grade and like a bit of a sound mix. But that's also what makes it charming.
I think even at the time we knew that, though. I think at the time
we definitely knew that.
We were like, quite have enough to make all of this sit together and be great. But we know we've got this like 10 minutes in here that are so good that if we can make, if we can kind of, you know, slap some tape around the rest and get it there, that that kind of 10 minutes is going to be so good, it's worth doing a film. Like, I still got kind of goosebumps on that final shot when you come around the corner and there's Uluru sitting there, and I watched it on Sunday night and I got goosebumps watching that. And that's a bit self-indulgent to say that you get goosebumps watching your own film, but it still means
a brilliant
a lot
shot,
and I
yeah.
think it, I think it works. So for all the things that don't quite work, which I think at the time we were like, fuck, I wish we had this. I wish we had more footage here, or we could pace this out more. But when it hits its stride.
In my mind too, I feel like making Thereabouts in the way that we did, we were like embracing, at least I feel like there was like this level of embracing like all of the imperfections. And because like I remember going, like I remember I'd come off of A Country Town Rescue, which is a long form documentary series for the ABC, which we'd shot over 18 months. And I'd sort of started on that as like an intern and then kind of gone through and was shooting stuff and interviewing by towards the end. And so I'd kind of like come up, that's what taught me how to shoot and make, you know, make film. And but during that process, I became so disheartened at like all of the stuff I found really interesting was like the camera might not have been fully in focus, or like, you know, it was because someone, it's real life, right? Like the sound guy might have been, you know, had the boom over the wrong person, and so he only caught like part of the sentence, and because of that you couldn't use it. Like you couldn't use, there was like this sort of standard of things that you couldn't use. And then also too, like I remember like everything had to be so voiceover heavy and like really explain everything that was going on. And I feel like when we were making, like when we were doing Thereabouts, like that scene in the car where Lockie tells the story, where you and Lockie, you tell the story about the gun, and then Lockie tells the story about kissing the like 200-year-old woman in Portugal, and there's no cutaways there. Like the cutaway, we use like the same shot twice to cover that, like, to get around like a jump cut. And it's just like, but it was fine. It works. Like someone just yesterday was talking to me about that scene, and they're like, you would that scene would be instantly cut, right? From like, well, never, you wouldn't even think to put it in anything else, but then when you watch it, you're like, in this film and in this context, like it works really well. And I think that's what we were doing. There was like an element of that, of like we'd made all of this polished television, or we'd been involved in the making of polished television, and this was our opportunity to like make it how we wanted to do it. And so there was like an element of embracing all of these like raw shitty moments to like, because that was like how it felt, I guess, and like how, like that was our sort of version of how we would make a film. And in that same way, like I definitely, like with the, like the there, but like the stuff that we've done since then, like I've taken that style and continued it through kind of everything we've done. I guess at times it's gotten more cinematic, and certainly the sound has gotten a little bit better, not much though. But tell me, what do you love about sport? What draws you to sports stories? You are a sporting fan in a big way.
Yeah, I love sport. I mean, Thereabouts is sort of the only time I've gotten to do it professionally in a lot of ways, but I love sport. I think I tell people who aren't into sport, who don't get it, which are, you know, quite a few people, and I'm like, it's the greatest human drama going. It's like, if you don't love sport, imagine sort of the best reality TV show you possibly can, but it's been going for like 200 years in some sports cases. And, you know, we sports an incredible, if you're a TV producer or something, how can you not look at sport and go, every sport is an arbitrary set of rules. Get this ball in the net, hit this ball over the rope, ride up this mountain. And then we get people from the age of, you know, 8 years old to perfect that thing. And then you get to a moment, you get to watch that kid in a final, in, you know, in a championship game, have to do that skill to change their lives. That human drama is, you can't beat that. And that's sport to me, is it's those stories and picking your heroes and your villains. That's what I love about sport, is watching some kid from a tiny town in Colombia or Ecuador, you know, as you get to watch that kid grow, you get to watch him then at finally the age of 30 win that race or win that game and change his life. And then, because sport just keeps going, maybe if you keep, you know, you're rewarded by following it, and then that kid becomes a coach, and then he ends up becoming a villain and is a tyrant. And you watch these characters change and grow. And, you know, I know that a lot of the guests you have on are kind of sports people and coaches, and they're sort of very interested in performance and, you know, their business and that kind of thing. But as a fan, that's what I love about sport.
Okay. So coming out of this situation, right, this current, you know, sport's been cancelled, right? That human drama is on pause right now. What happens to sport? What does it look like? You know, what do you hope it looks like? Do you want it to resume as it was?
It's a fascinating question. I think sports, I'm really interested to see how sports people react. I think, you know, at the beginning of this, there were a lot of sports people going, I just want to get out there. I just want to play the game I love. Right. I just want to race. I just want to do it. Let's get back out there. Let's get back to normal. And I hope that as this has gone on and become more serious, and we're seeing, you know, all these lives being lost and everything, that, and we realize that playing sport right now is actually dangerous. And it's not necessarily about that we want to go out and compete. It's actually kind of dangerous to go out and compete for a lot of people, depending on where you live. And I hope that sports people, when this is over, kind of look, and, you know, sports people, generally speaking, sports people see themselves as self-made. They think that they are responsible for their success or failure. They're the only person who has control of their own destiny. And coming out of this, I think we have to say that solutions to this and all problems have to be collective. And what's the point of, if you feel like you can go out and race right now and that you're safe, maybe you are. But if the whole sport comes back right now, maybe it's the kid from a third world country on his first contract who gets sick. And maybe it destroys his lungs, and maybe his career's over. So you can't just think about yourself as a sports person. You have to think collectively. And I hope sports people come out of this going, oh, right, it's our health and our livelihood and our income that really is the thing that gets bit at the end of a crisis, whether that's a pandemic or a global recession or whatever. It's our health and our bodies on the line, and let's take a collective approach to this and look after each other and make sure that, you know, veterans and, you know, young athletes and all those people who don't necessarily get paid the biggest money, don't necessarily get looked after the most, are being looked after, because, you know, sport has to make sure that it's looking after. And even the mechanics, the staff, you know, the masseuses, the whatever, you know, sport is a very individualistic industry. And I think as an industry, hopefully it becomes a bit more collective and people start looking after each other a bit better out of this. Because I'm sure when this is over and we take stock, there's going to be a lot of stories of young athletes and people, you know, losing a lot as a result of this. And it's going to take a while for those stories to come out, but I've got no doubt there's going to be stories of, you know, pretty vulnerable people who ended up losing a lot out of these seasons being cancelled. And I hope we look after them when this is done. As to what the product looks like on screens, it's really interesting. You know, I wonder whether, you know, I think you look at what the NBA is going to be coming back, I think probably pretty soon, in, you know, maybe 6 weeks, 8 weeks. They haven't announced anything, but that's the sense that's coming. And I think they're going to do all kinds of things to try and make it a more cinematic experience. Because there's no fans, so what do you got to? You got to try and make it entertaining somehow. So I think there's kind of exciting creative potential for how do you shoot sport differently, races differently. And that's all going to be really exciting. But I hope it comes out with some kind of welfare for the players at the heart of it. You got any ideas on what you want to see at the other side of this?
No, I would have to say I like line up very, very, very much in the same way that you are. I think I would like to see, like, first of all, athletes recognize their responsibility within society, even like to extend what you said even further, right? The idea, for example, of the idea of the Tour de France going ahead right now, like that's, you know, like there's like 5,000 people involved in that production, right? And that traveling around, you know, a country like is obviously like in a time of pandemic, extremely risky. But beyond that, like, so that's obviously the idea is like, who are we impacting by going out and performing in our sport? And that's one thing. And then the other thing too, is like people watch sports stars and if they see them out riding or they see them out doing something, then they're like, oh, well that's okay. So I'll go out and do it. So it's even beyond, just them directly doing something. And then recognizing that power and then going, well, how do we wield this in when all this pandemic's gone and we're back to normal life and there's no such thing as social distancing? These athletes still have that power. Like they might not have recognized it before, or it might not have been as overtly like the impact of that as overt as what it is right now. And so then recognizing that and then by extension of that going, okay, well, what role do we now play in society that's beyond us just playing our game? And so I would like to see that become, for athletes, like that become more of a thing. Certainly and there are athletes that do this, and I think that there's definitely needs... this is an interesting point, right? Like you could argue, and I've spoken with the head of the sports governance here at Colorado University, right? And so the case of like Colin Kaepernick, you could argue what he stood for in the bravery and what he did was really remarkable, but the outcome, like did he actually advance that issue? And you could argue that, like, you know, him v. Trump, like Trump could arguably have come out in front in that situation and he could have alienated himself in a way that has been more detrimental to his cause than not.
Yeah, and I very much hesitate to weigh into a debate with a professor of sports ethics because I'm hardly that. But I, you know, my view on the Kaepernick thing is that, you know, I just wonder what would we be saying about, you know, the 68 Olympics and the Black Power salute. I'm sure in the couple of years after that, people would have been saying, oh, well, it was very distasteful and, you know, it alienated a lot of people. You know, a lot of white folks sitting on their couches felt really that was quite aggressive, you know. But ultimately they won that, you know, that debate, that cultural moment.
Right.
And that's now memorialized and rightly celebrated. And I wonder whether... You know, for everyone who, you know, Trump can say that he did whip up a lot of support around the Kaepernick thing. Fox News obviously covered that a lot and used it to their advantage. But I hope that in the long term, that's viewed as, you know, how many Americans were talking about police violence before he started kneeling, you know, and how many more people are speaking today. And I just wonder whether it's a slightly short-term view to go, well, that was a big win for Trump. I think it's still obviously open to debate and history is going to be the judge. But I think that athletes shouldn't be scared off taking, you know, some pretty controversial positions if they believe in them. And I, you know, I don't even know how controversial Kaepernick's position is really. It seems pretty open and shut to me, pretty straightforward. Right. And you know, I think athlete, you know, sport, when people say, you know, sport's becoming so politicized today, well, sport has been politicized for a long, long time. I'd argue that, you know, sport is a much safer place without a lot of politicization today. I mean, if the most controversial thing that happens is that LeBron James and some NBA players wear I Can't Breathe t-shirts, you know, wear a t-shirt, and that's right. Kind of, you know, people are criticizing them and sponsors are freaking out and looking to pull out. Like, that isn't that risky. It's, you know, that's some really, you know, basic solidarity that they're showing, and that's fantastic. But, you know, athletes of, you know, 70 years ago were doing, you know, far more risky things, you know, running as a black man and winning a gold medal in front of Hitler at the games in Germany is a really political act, you know, and
and like high risk.
And high risk. So I think sport has an incredible and should be, you know, celebrated history of politicization. And when people kind of go like, oh, I just, you know, I remember back in the day before sport was political, I just am going, no, I think you were maybe just too young to realize it was political. You know, when you were watching the sports stars you loved, I promise you there was politics going on. You know, there were people from countries that were, you know, when you see, say, like Algerians playing for the French national team and you know, talking about singing the Nigerian anthem and feeling more Algerian than French, you know, that was incredibly political. That was in the 90s. You know, you're saying you feel more, you know, Zidane said, I'm Algerian first, a man from Marseille second, and a Frenchman third. And they hated him for it. You know, there were times when I think they'd even won the World Cup, but the French fans were booing them for talking about, you know, Algerian, you know, independence and nationalism. This stuff has been going a long time. And anyway, you know, I hope maybe if there's some good to come out of an awful, awful situation, it's that athletes recognize that they have, you know, they can play a big role in how society reshapes itself after this. Sport's really important. Everyone wants sport back right now. Everyone wants to be able to go out and train in sport and go down to their local club and have a kick and have a whatever. And so sport's going to be a part of remaking society when this is all over. And hopefully athletes like take an active role and go, I want to be part of how sport comes back. And I want to have some agency in that. And whether that's supporting my local club where I grew up, and making sure those kids can play sport safely, or whether that's taking some big giant stand on, you know, a social issue or the economics of how we're going to get out of this. Like, you know, yeah, I hope they play a role.
Favorite sporting match and event of all time?
I was thinking about this. I think my favorite sporting match I've ever seen was probably South Sydney versus the Canterbury Bulldogs in the 2014 Rugby League Grand Final. Rugby League, for people who don't know, is like a combination of rugby that you'd probably know in the US and basically NFL. It's like it's a battering ram against a wall of a sport. It's just men running at each other with no pads, no helmets. It's the closest team sport gets to combat, and it's an incredible game. Sam Burgess, player for South Sydney, which is a very has a lot of ties to the Aboriginal community, but Sam's from England, and he broke his cheek in the first 5 minutes of that game, broke his cheekbone, like clean break, and he played the entire rest of the game with a broken cheekbone, didn't have a minute off the field on the substitutes bench, and him crying at the end. And Russell Crowe, the actor, owns that team, and when they won the game, Russell came down onto the ground, and Sam is just crying into Russell Crowe's arms, which is one of the most just bizarre, amazing, beautiful moments in sport I can remember. And Greg Inglis is an Aboriginal player in Australia, Indigenous player, who basically went to that club because they have a connection to the Indigenous community. He scores the last try of that game. I'm pretty sure it's the last try. And he runs the whole length of the field, and he's crying before he's scored it. He's running, and he knows they can't catch him. And he realizes they're going to win, and he starts crying mid-sprint. And that is absolutely astonishing. So that is one of my favorite sports matches of all time. I would, if even one American listening to this pulls that up on YouTube and watches that game, I'll be so happy. That would be hilarious.
Well, dude, I feel like we've chinwagged for long enough, and we should probably wrap it up there. But, dude, it was really good to get you on, and it was really great to reminisce about, you know, about that film that kind of, certainly for me at least, completely changed my life, and also too to hear your thoughts on the role of sport.
Mate, I very much hope we can do it again.
Absolutely.
I'd like to be your kind of, you know, it was really obvious if you ever watched like David Letterman, it was obvious when the guest had cancelled because he had like Regis Philbin on or someone. He just always had somebody on speed dial. Or like if you listen to the Bill Simmons podcast, he's got his old friend Joe House. So right. I'd love to be your, you know, whenever a guest cancels, just get your old mate Scott Mitchell on. And I'll plug a gap.
Well, that's all we're going to give it. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Thereabouts Outspoken podcast. It's been a gas. Once again, I'd like to apologize for the film that was meant to launch this week. We will, you know, get to you as soon as we know any more on when that will be happening. Until then, though, maybe go back and watch a couple of the old ones. Go back and, you know, get in touch with Scott Mitchell's Thereabouts. Or you could just, you know, go back and have a listen to some of the previous editions of the podcast. I'll leave that decision up to you.
Appreciate everybody subscribing and following along and sending questions and recommendations or just, you know, emails to us. Howdy@thereabouts.co is our email address. And our Instagram is here or thereabouts. So yeah, thanks everybody for listening. I'm Isaac Carson, still reporting from the Pacific Northwest.
And from the Rocky Mountain Range, it's Angus Morton. Take it easy, people.